Afternoon session. We'll hear some more thermodynamic talks now. And our first speaker is Howard Barnum from University of New Mexico. He will talk about entropy, majorization, and thermodynamics in general probabilistic systems.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Marcus and Philip and Richard, for organizing this conference and inviting me. So I noticed that later in the week, we're going to hear from Richard about going beyond the spectral paradigm. And after the end of this talk, you're going to want to be going beyond the spectral paradigm because it's going to be mired in it. So some of the results I'm going to talk about, particularly this majorization, I think overlap a little bit with what Giulio talked about earlier, some of the results he and Carla Maria have. I think that purification and dilating processes to reversible processes are extremely important in thermodynamics, and hope to, we've been thinking about making that part of the work we're doing. But a lot of the stuff I'm going to be talking about is actually based on single system properties. And in fact, I'm going to start out. I noticed that Rüdiger said that most of the work being done in quantum foundations involves properties of composite systems. I'm going to start out by reviewing a derivation or characterization of, let's say, the finite dimensional Hilbert space quantum theory framework that Cosmin Ududek and Marcus Müller and I recently did. I think it was in New Journal of Physics 2014. And that actually uses only single system properties. So maybe that's an exception to that general rule. And one reason for reviewing it is then a lot of the properties that we use in this reconstruction of quantum theory, or closely related properties or consequences of some combinations of them, are going to be useful in getting some preliminary results on thermodynamics in generalized probabilistic theories as well. So what do I mean by generalized probabilistic theory? I think, actually, is everybody here fairly familiar with this generalized probabilistic theories framework? Probably there are some people who aren't, some students think. So I'm just going to very quickly go through it. I think Giulio gave an excellent introduction to the general idea, which is that we're thinking probabilistically about systems. What are the probabilities of different processes that might occur, different measurement outcomes? So a theory is basically a set of systems. A system is specified by a bounded convex set of allowed states in some real affine space. And then we have some set of allowed measurements, allowed dynamics compatible with each measurement outcome. You could look at it as a category. And as Giulio mentioned, you can justify all this from operational considerations about I'm going to manipulate systems and different transformations might happen, and I might do two transformations in a row, and what's the probability of that? I'm not going to go through all that generalization, but I occasionally do get the statement, well, isn't all this stuff about assuming a convex set and this and that, very restrictive in and of itself? And the answer is no, it's not. Okay, composite system, I'm not going to be talking too much about that. At the end, I may talk a little bit about some composites of a particular class of systems called Jordan algebraic systems. That's some work with Matthew Graydon, Alex Wills, and it actually started through also discussions of cause here. So it's a very weakly constraining framework. So here's the characterization of finite dimensional Hilbert space quantum theory that I'm going to start out with. And it's based on four postulates. The first is weak spectrality. Every state is in the convex hull of a set of perfectly distinguishable pure states. And by pure in this framework, since we don't assume an underlying Hilbert space, I just mean it's extremal in the set of possible states. So for example, if the state space is a triangle, which is the probability simplex over three outcomes, it's a classical system. These are the extremal states. They can't be written as non-trivial convex combinations of other states. They're, in a sense, states of maximal knowledge, maximal possible knowledge. Okay, strong symmetry, again, involves this notion of a set of perfectly distinguishable pure states. And by perfectly distinguishable intuitively, I just mean there's a measurement that if you know it was one of these three states, or whatever number of states that were prepared, it will tell you which one. Perfect reliability. Okay, so every set of perfectly distinguishable pure states transforms to any other such set of the same size via a reversible transformation. What's a reversible transformation? Well, remember I said there's this compact convex set of states, right? So for a qubit, it's just the block ball. You know, for a three-state classical system, it's this triangle. And a reversible transformation is an affine automorphism of that convex set. It preserves convex combinations. And reversibly means it takes the set onto itself, not into itself. There are perfectly good transformations that might, for instance, project your classical state space onto a two-dimensional subspace. That's fine, but that's not reversible. So in quantum mechanics, reversible is just density matrix rho goes to u rho u dagger. Okay. And the quantum version of this weak spectrality is just, you know, the eigen decomposition of a density matrix. Write it as a convex combination of rank one orthogonal projectors. So we're abstracting all these things from quantum theory. The third axiom is a little more complicated to state. It's that there is no irreducible three alternative interference. And that's basically, in a sense, defined by Raphael Sorkin that we've adapted to our framework. And I will go into more detail about what that is later. The fourth of these postulates we call energy observability. So we say systems have non-trivial, continuously parameterized reversible dynamics. So for example, for the block ball, it's just rotations of the block ball. And the generators of one parameter continuous subgroups, which if you want to think about them, they're like free time evolution. You can think of them as Hamiltonians, but we're not necessarily in quantum theory. The generators of these continuous subgroups are associated with non-trivial observables that are actually conserved by the dynamics they generate. So it's kind of a Noether's theorem abstraction of Noether's theorem kind of thing, association of reversible evolution with conserved quantities. Okay, so the results that we got were that if you take all four of them, you get a standard quantum system over the complex numbers. And this is a, everything I'm going to be talking about is in finite dimensions. If you just take the first three, you get so-called Jordan algebraic systems. And they have to be irreducible. I'll say what that is in a moment. And classical systems. And if you just take the first two axioms, you still get extremely strong properties. The system has to be what I'm going to call projective. And the cone of states has to be self-dual. Okay, so let's get a little more into, okay, here's the reference. And this is actually an open access journal article, so you can get all the spiffy typeset version if you like, and there's also an archived version. Okay.
Howard,
yes?
Clarification.
Yeah.
Once you add the requirement 4, does classical mechanics satisfied still, or
That's a very good question. So because we're operating in finite dimensions, classical mechanics doesn't satisfy this. And it's a bit of a cheat because we define it to say there's non-trivial, continuously parameterized reversible dynamics, right? So, you know, what are the reversible transformations of this? They're just, you know, the dihedral group with three alternatives. I mean, you can just, you know, you can rotate the triangle. It's a very small, it's a discrete group. That's what I wanted to say. So, you know, in general, it's the symmetric group over the number of distinguishable alternatives. If you want a more conceptual way of distinguishing classical from quantum, there are all kinds of easy ways to do the job, right? You say there's a no cloning result or all sorts of things. So in a sense, the fact that we're ruling out classical mechanics here is no big deal. If you went to an infinite dimensional system, classical systems could have continuously parameterized reversible dynamics. And then you would have to introduce an explicit, some other way of ruling it out. And it would be by one of these many information theoretic things, saying there's an information disturbance trade-off, non-unique decomposability of mixed states into pure states. So you can still get a conceptual derivation that gets you to quantum theory and rules out the classical. But good question. Okay, so basically what we do in this framework, we take our set of normalized states and we pop it into one higher dimension and we look at all the non-negative multiples of things in it, and that's our unnormalized state space. It's a so-called cone, convex cone. I'm going to call it A+. Measurement outcomes are the linear functionals, so they go to the real numbers. We call them effects. Their values on normalized states are probabilities. The unit effect, and that's this, the unit effect is the thing that has value 1 on all normalized states, right? So like if you stick this probability simplex in its usual embedding, right, into 3 space, that's an example of this construction, and then the, you know, positive, the non-negative orthant is the unnormalized state space. Quantum theory, it's the positive semi-definite matrices. Okay, effects generate the dual cone of functionals non-negative on the unnormalized states. Skip all that. Okay, and often instead of talking about the dual space and putting the effects in the dual space, you introduce an inner product. And you say, we're going to represent the effects also by things in our space. And probabilities are going to be obtained by just evaluating the inner product. And effectively, you're identifying the dual space with the primal space this way. I think, you know, Lucien kind of revived this whole operational theories thing around 2000. He used that formalism. An interesting thing about, this notion of introducing an interproduct is actually important to one of the geometric properties we're going to discuss of systems. So let's define the internal dual cone, which is the dual cone relative to this representation, as the set of all things that have non-negative interproduct with everything in the primal cone, A+. Okay, so that's isomorphic to this other way of defining the dual cone. It's actually in the dual space. And now, if there exists an inner product relative to which this dual cone, actually this internal dual cone, is identical to the primal cone, then the system is called self-dual, or the cone is called self-dual. And it's stronger than just saying the two things are isomorphic, the dual cone and the primal cone. And the example of that is the square-based state space. Right? The dual cone is isomorphic, but it's rotated 45 degrees. And for those of you who know PR boxes, this is the state space of one PR system. Not the entangled system of two, but one system. Okay, and somehow it's related to time reversal because you're basically saying, except for considerations of normalization, you know, the effects and the states are the same things. Interestingly, in the classical and quantum example, I mean, things actually are self-dual, right? And the inner product we use for the representation is just the trace inner product for quantum theory, and it's just the dot product for classical. We'll talk a little bit about Jordan algebraic systems. And I don't think I'll go over everything on this slide. It's a notion that was introduced. I mean, the prime reason for being interested is that the first three axioms I've talked about in this characterization get you to Jordan algebraic systems. Pascual Jordan introduced it. It abstracts properties of permission operators. He thought maybe this is actually the right algebraic setting for doing quantum mechanics back in the 30s. And so it basically just, it's saying there's a vector space that is similar to the space of Hermitian observables in quantum theory in that you can equip it with this product, which is nice because it preserves Hermitianness, so it preserves observableness. And he added this identity. So the thing is not associative. This is commutative, but it's not associative. But it does satisfy this special case of associativity. Making it formally real just says the sum of any two squares being zero means the two things are zero. And that means the cone of squares is a good candidate for an unnormalized state space, just like in quantum theory where, you know, any Hermitian matrix times its dagger, or sorry, any Hermitian matrix squared is going to have non-negative eigenvalues, so it's going to be positive semi-definite. So that's a candidate for an unnormalized state, right? And then you just chop through that cone with your normalization affine plane, trace equals 1, and you get a convex compact set of states. So this is necessary to get the squares onto the state space. And then your Don von Neumann and Wigner, a year or two later, actually characterized the finite dimensional formally real systems. And these are actually the irreducible or simple ones. The others are just sums of them. And so they're basically real complex and quaternionic quantum theory, systems whose state space is a ball, which are often called spin factors. And these have cropped up, for instance, in Luis Massanis and Marcus Mueller have a derivation of quantum theory where one assumption is that bits are balls. So they're talking about bits being spin factors. And then there's this weird one, the exceptional Jordan algebra, 3x3 Hermitian octonionic matrices. Okay. And incidentally, these are precisely also the finite dimensional homogeneous self-dual cones. I describe self-duality. Maybe this isn't so important. Homogeneity just means that the automorphism group of the cone itself, not necessarily preserving normalization, acts transitively on the interior. So any interior state can go to any other by an automorphism. Okay, reducibility is a little bit of an important concept. We say a cone is irreducible in a vector space A if the vector space is a direct sum of two spaces and all the extremal rays of the cone are either in space 1 or space 2. So what's an extremal ray? Well, you remember I said the cone has a distinguished base. Let's just draw this classical cone again. There were three extremal states. Each of them generates an extremal ray. It's just the non-negative multiples of extremal states. In quantum theory, the rank 1 projectors are the extremal states, and their non-negative multiples are extremal rays. And so the point is, if you can do this, it's like there's super selection sectors. There's no coherence between them. And which sector you're in is classical information. Okay, face of a convex set, it's a subset such that if you have something in that subset and you can write it as a convex combination of other things in the convex set, those other things also have to be in the set. All the faces we're going to be interested in are so-called exposed faces. Those are just intersections of the cone with a supporting hyperplane. Again, just think of the convex set of a classical trit. What are the faces? Each extremal point is a face. Each edge is a face, including the endpoints. And the whole thing is a face. So in other words, you can pick this out with a hyperplane. You can pick out the edge with a supporting hyperplane. And by convention, the hyperplane of things orthogonal to 0, let's say, is by convention, the whole thing is a face as well. OK. Important thing for us about faces is that if we take an effect, the space on which it's 0 and the space of states on which it's 1 are faces of the cone. So they're going to be closely connected to distinguishability, which we're interested in. Okay, states are perfectly distinguishable if there are allowed effects that add up to less than our unit effect. So they're a legal measurement. It means their probabilities on any state will add up to less than 1. And the fact that they're, of course, in the dual cone means their probabilities are greater than 0. Such that EI of omega j is delta ij. So if I get outcome I know state omega j was prepared, given that the state was drawn from this initial set. Okay. And in fact, for any measurement or set of effects that adds up to less than the unit, so it could be part of a measurement, the one set of an effect and the zero set of the effects in the measurement, the set of things on which a given effect is 1 is a subset of the set of things for which all the other effects are 0 for every other effect. So any measurement distinguishes, with elements EI, distinguishes the faces F1 sub I from each other. Those could be empty if it doesn't even have a set on which one. But faces, distinguishability is states is the reason we're interested in them. Okay, and we might call a set of perfectly distinguishable states a frame. Okay. Another important concept is the concept of filters. It's a convex abstraction of the projection postulate, basically, or at least Luder's version. So rho goes to Q, rho Q. Q is the orthogonal projector onto some subspace of Hilbert space. And it's helpful for many reasons. One of them is in abstracting the notion of interference to this broader setting. So what is it? It's a normalized positive linear map. Okay, and so normalized means that, remember we have this normalization functional U that tells us in this cone, what are the normalized states? Normalization means that if you start out with a normalized state, you may take something, you may take it to a state with U less than or equal to 1, but you'll never take it to something with U bigger than 1. So you can always interpret U of the state after the process as the probability with which that process happened on that initial state. So normalized and positive just mean that it's a decent candidate for a physical operation. P squared equals P, that means it's idempotent, it's a projector. And P and its adjoint both have to be complemented. Complemented means there's a filter P prime such that its image as a linear map intersected with the state space is the kernel of, sorry, that the P's image intersected with the state space is the kernel of P prime intersected with the state space. In other words, you can think of things passing or failing filters. And what it's saying is if you pass filter P, you always fail filter P prime, and vice versa.
Sorry, how would you define the P adjoint if we're out of Hilbert space framework?
So maybe I shouldn't have said adjoint. It's just the dual linear operator, which
so there is this self-duality is already assumed.
Okay, we're not assuming self-duality.
Okay.
It's a property that sometimes we assume for certain results. But the point is there's always the dual space. Let's call it A star. A is our primal space. And just given the pairing, I mean, it's defined this way. You have the canonical pairing between a space and its dual space, which is just evaluating functionals. So you have x, p, y, well, okay, we're defining p star by the condition that p star x, y is equal to x on p, y for all x and y.
Okay.
So it's just like in, you know, quantum theory. And if you'd have the representation where you don't use the dual space, but you use an inner product, same thing. Yeah, I mean, this complemented adjoint is part of this definition that is least sort of intuitively appealing to me. And I've tried to get rid of it, but I haven't figured out a way to substitute something that's more obvious. It's sort of saying, well, the Heisenberg picture has to make sense too. Okay, this is the dual of a notion that Alfsein and Schultz introduced called compression. Yeah.
So this is a mathematical definition. You don't need it in the axioms,
no? We don't need it in the axioms. It pops out of the first two axioms.
Yeah.
That every face is the positive part of the image of one of these filters.
So somehow everything is already arrived.
Yeah, but then in other things I do later, I'm going to actually assume that every face is the positive part of the image of one of these filters, and maybe assume some weaker than the rest of our axioms. Okay, they're neutral, right? So this is basically saying if it preserves the norm, it actually doesn't disturb the state. So if you pass the filter with certainty, you pass it undisturbed. Again, like the projection postulate. Okay, so we call a state space projective if every face is the positive part of the image of a filter. Okay, so this is sort of left over from an earlier talk, but the first two postulates, which are this weak spectrality and this very strong symmetry property of taking any set of distinguishable states to any other reversibly, which, you know, quantum theoretically, that's just saying, if I take any orthogonal set of rank 1 projectors and I conjugate them all by the same unitary, I get an orthogonal set of rank 1 projectors. Those two already imply, well, they imply the effect cone is the full dual cone. They imply self-duality. And they actually imply something stronger called perfection. Every face is self-dual in its own span according to the restriction of the same inner product. So self-duality says I can choose an inner product that makes makes the cone equal to its own internal dual. And this is saying every face is self-dual in this strong sense, where I don't even have to change the inner product within the face to make it happen. Okay, I will skip these things. The way these things end up implying that we have filters onto every face is just that the orthogonal projection with respect to this self-dualizing inner product is in fact a positive operator and a filter. Okay, the faces form a lattice. I think I'm not going to say a lot about this lattice. Right, it's a partially ordered set with least upper bounds and greatest lower bounds. And if you just order the faces by set inclusion, you get a lattice. Complemented lattice, okay, we have a bounded lattice because there's the empty face and there's the face that's the full set, and those are basically 0 and 1, lower bounds and upper bounds for everything else. And then this is the definition of a complement. If you can find something such that it's join x prime is the top, and x meet x prime is the bottom, the greatest lower bound is the lowest thing in the lattice, that's a complement. It's orthocomplemented if the complement reverses the order. And then you get De Morgan's laws. Okay. And then there's an even stronger property called orthomodularity, which I think the easiest way to, well, I'm just thinking, actually, it's not that important that I go into orthomodularity. It's an old notion from quantum logic. You might almost say that orthomodular lattices are quantum logics. And in our projective systems, right, we can define a complementation by F prime is just the positive part of the image of the complementary projector. And that turns out to be an orthocomplementation. You know, it gives you nice contextuality properties. It's a very nice, strong property. I think I'm not going to use it a lot in what follows, so I'll pass over it in the interest of time. Okay, multi-slit interference. So let's say we've got filters onto every face now. So now if we have a set of filters onto a distinguishable set of faces, we could put them together into one experiment as alternative processes. And maybe they would actually be associated with different slits in, you know, determining whether a particle went through some slit or not, or down some arm of an interferometer. So we're going to say a K-slit mask is a set of K filters under distinguishable faces. And then we define this notation for a subset of these indices. We look at the join of the projectors. In other words, the projectors onto the face generated by their two faces or three faces or whatever the faces are in this set. Important to realize this is not the sum of the projectors, right? Because the sum of the well, we're going to see that in a second. And I'm going to use this notation, you know, P sub 1, 2, 3 is the join of P1, P2, and P3, et cetera. Okay. And what are the, okay, these again, are these in quantum theory, it's these maps where the different QI project onto orthogonal subspaces of the Hilbert space. Okay. Second order interference says that the projector P1, 2 is not equal to the sum of the projectors onto the individual alternatives. Third-order interference says if I add up, you know, all the two-slit subprojectors for the experiment, and then I subtract off all the one-slit projectors because there was some overlap, I don't get the overall three-slit projector. So I can't make up a three-slit interference pattern out of two-slit, adding up two-slit interference patterns and then subtracting off the overlaps. Okay, it's easy to see this is zero in quantum theory, either at the density matrix or the pure state level. Okay. And then this was just like some kind of inclusion-exclusion principle to account for overlaps. You can easily generalize it to order K interference. Here are some references. Cosman, Joe Emerson, and I wrote some stuff about this. And there's more in Kahn's thesis. No kth order interference implies no k plus first order interference. OK, Okay, and also to say that there's no kth order interference is to say, if we look at all, if you look at any k, okay, let's just skip that. Time is running out. So I don't think that's too important. But no kth order interference. You don't have to worry about higher order interference. Okay. Another concept we're going to use quite a bit is symmetry of transition probabilities. So remember, we said there's projectivity, and that means for every atomic projective unit, and that's just, if you like, that's just an observable that says, am I in this face or not? I mean, you get it by applying the adjoint of the filter to your unit effect, which always gives one. The face P omega, the image, in the normalized states, contains just a single pure state. So we'll call it P hat. And then the map from P to P hat associates these atomic effects, if you like, these effects that are on extremal rays, to extremal points of your state space. And then symmetry of transition probabilities just says, well, if I have two such atomic effects, A of B hat has to be equal to B of A hat. And in quantum theory, these are indeed what are usually called transition probabilities between pure states. Okay, and then we rediscovered this theorem by Araki, 1980, actually, which is that if you have projectivity, so this filters on every face, then symmetry of transition probabilities is actually the same thing as this very strong form of self-duality of your cone, which is called perfection. Every face is self-dual in its span. Okay. Okay, so how do we characterize these systems? Well, we use the theorem of Alfstein and Schultz, which basically says if you have projectivity, STP, and if filters preserve purity, and this is related to something that Giulio mentioned, I believe, if omega is a pure state, then P omega is a non-negative multiple of a pure state. That's a case of Giulio's purity axiom. Not purification, but the one about two pure transformations, their composition is a pure transformation. Okay, then omega is the state space of one of these formally real Jordan algebras. So it's very close to quantum theory, actually. Okay, so the way our result worked was to show that this weak spectrality plus the strong symmetry gives us projectivity and, in fact, symmetry of transition probabilities. So already perfection. And then if you add in no higher order interference, you get filters preserve purity. So that's basically how our derivation worked. Okay, and then our last assumption was energy observability. I think I described it fairly well before, so let's maybe not go into the details and just remind you that if you add one more thing, energy observability, you get down to a complex Hilbert space. Okay, an alternative to filters preserving purity in that Alfstein-Schultz theorem is a so-called covering law for the face lattice. So an element of B of a lattice covers an element A if it's below B, if A is below B and there's nothing between them. And an atom is something that covers zero. So in quantum theory, the lattice of projectors, it's the rank one projectors. Covering law says for every element and every atom, this is like a face in our face lattice. Either the join of these two things, this should be F, I apologize. So either adjoining another atom doesn't do anything because it's already in the face, for instance, if it's a face lattice, or adjoining another atom gives you something that, and that should again be F, I believe. Yeah, covers the face. So if this fails on a face lattice, you can have this weird thing happen where, I mean, of course, this doesn't actually happen for classical lattices, but let's say I have this convex set of a classical bit. Well, I join in one more atom, and then I get this face. And that's actually the next thing up in the face lattice of a trit. But maybe if I had some bigger lattice, it could be that I do this and I get some face, but there's some other atom such that if I join it in, I get some huge face that includes this, but a whole bunch of other atoms, and that would violate the covering law. All right, that's an alternative to this filters preserving purity. That's in a lattice theoretical alternative. All right, so now how does all this relate to thermodynamics? Well, if you just think about protocols that people talk about for moving between, let's say, non-equilibrium states with adiabatic and isothermal processes and with the free energy telling you whether you can do it or not, you know, they tend to talk about the spectra and entropy. I mean, you kind of need spectra to define entropies. You want plenty of reversible transformations so that when you do your adiabatic processes, they do what you want. You can find them to go between states. If you want to be a Maxwell's demon, you might want measurements that use filters so they don't disturb the state when you measure it if it's in the place you expect it to be. You need some definition of energy. So maybe, you know, associating with the generators of reversible evolutions is reasonable. And you might also want to be able to measure it, calculate its expectation value, things like that. So maybe we'll need energy observability. At any rate, we'll need some version of energy. And I would kind of like it if we did not need filters preserving purity or no higher order interference. But it's an open question and one of the most interesting ones, because if you do really need it to get a decent thermodynamics, then you may narrow things down very close to quantum already, particularly if you need energy observability in light of our earlier results. Okay, so initial results relevant to thermal. I'm going to introduce this notion of unique spectrality. Every state has a decomposition into perfectly distinguishable pure states, and all such decompositions use the same probabilities. Okay, so it's actually stronger than weak spectrality. If you add strong symmetry, right, in our derivation, we have unique spectrality, because strong symmetry then makes weak spectrality into strong spectrality. But it's easy to find examples even where you have decompositions into different numbers of pure states, even though you have weak spectrality. Okay, majorization. Take two vectors. X is majorized by Y. If you order both vectors of real numbers in decreasing order, and then you look at the partial sums, and if all the partial sums on X are bigger, then the partial sums, is majorized by, okay. So if all the partial sums of Y are bigger than that for X, Y majorizes X. This might be the reverse direction from how Jonathan Oppenheim defined it. And people you do both ways in the literature. Anyway, if Y majorizes X, Y is less mixed than X. In particular, X can always be written as a convex combination of permutations of Y, and that's a very natural meaning for more mixed than. Okay, a measurement is fine-grained if the effects are atomic, i.e. on extremal range. Okay, and so here's the theorem, and this is with Jonathan Barrett, Marcus, and Marius Krum, who is also here, a master's student of Marcus at Heidelberg. Let's say we have unique spectrality, symmetry of transition probabilities, and projectivity. Or equivalently, we could just assume perfection and unique spectrality by this theorem of Araki that we rediscovered. Then for any state omega and fine-grained measurement E1 through EN, the probabilities of the measurement outcomes are majorized by the probabilities of outcomes for a spectral measurement on omega, right? We write omega as a convex combination of distinguishable states. The spectral measurement is the measurement that distinguishes those states. Okay, so this is true in quantum mechanics, right? The entropy of measurement outcome probabilities is always higher, for instance, than the entropy of the eigenvalues of the density matrix. Yes.
10 minutes.
Okay. And that's 10 before questions or 10? Okay. All right. So a corollary of this is that if omega prime can be written as a convex combination, and I made it a continuous one, of...
including questions.
Including, okay. of reversible transformations, then it's... then it's more mixed than omega. I'm not sure if I wrote the order right there. Okay. So we call a function sure concave if it is increasing with, let's say, decreasing with majorization. So if the more intuitive, the more mixed states have a higher value of it. It's like an entropy. It's monotone over mixing. So that's a function of, let's say, probabilities. And in fact, every concave symmetric function of probabilities or real numbers is sure concave. So increases with the inverse of majorization. OK, and then we can define measurement, preparation, and spectral entropies, or entropy-like quantities, from these sure concave functions. So for the measurement one, we minimize over fine-grained measurements the function applied to the measurement outcome probabilities. That should say prep. The preparation entropy, if you like, is the minimum over convex decompositions into pure states of the entropy of the decomposition probabilities. And the spectral entropy for whatever this generalized entropy is just apply the function to the spectrum, to those probabilities of spectral decomposition. For example, the Renyi entropies, this is their definition, they depend on alpha. And then for alpha, so this is anything in 0 to infinity, except for 0, 1, and infinity, where you have to take a limit. This is just minus log of the size of the support of the probability distribution, so log of the dimension of the number of things that can have non-zero probabilities. For 1, it's just the ordinary entropy, concave and sure concave. So they're monotonic. So if we have a perfect system, again, with spectrality, and that's unique spectrality, the measurement entropy, if you like, generalized entropy, is equal to the spectral entropy. That's what this should say. So an operational kind of definition that you might expect to be relevant to thermodynamic protocols is equal to this spectral notion. Now, occasionally, and so in particular, it's true for the Renyi entropies. Let's assume now a few stronger things. These are some things that appear in Marius' master's thesis. Weak spectrality and also strong symmetry. So that's a bit stronger than just this perfection and spectrality and unique spectrality. Right? So if we just say perfection, we actually have to say unique spectrality, because we don't know that perfection and weak spectrality implies unique spectrality. Here we can just say weak and we get unique for free. Okay, H2 for preparation is always equal to H2 measurement, the collision entropies, if you like. Okay, and here's another thing. Again, with these two assumptions, if the preparation, the zero preparation measurement, the Renyi zero entropy for preparation is equal to the measurement Renyi zero entropy, then we actually have no higher order interference and vice versa. And so we get Jordan algebraic systems. And basically, this thing about the size of support is the covering law, given the background assumptions. So this maybe could enable some purification axiom that implies that the preparation and measurement entropies are equal. Basically, if you have steering, locally tomographic purification, and the marginals are identical, then any measurement, any decomposition entropies can be realized as measurement entropies. So these are equal. It might allow you to derive Jordan algebraic systems. These are pretty darn strong assumptions. Marcus, do you remember if local tomography and these two already get us to?
I think so.
You think they already get us to quantum theory?
Yeah.
Yeah, OK. You don't have to assume that a bit is a ball. You get that for free.
Yeah, with some fine print that we should discuss later.
OK, OK, all right. So OK, that this may not be that surprising, let's say. OK, you can do relative entropy. So I think the main thing to take away is that
given these fairly weak assumptions, we've got some spectral quantities that look like they're good, good ingredients, a good notion of entropy for talking about thermodynamics in this abstract setting. And now we'd really like to talk about thermodynamic protocols, work, all the stuff that Jonathan was talking about before lunch, and ask, can we do similar things in this setting, and what are the quantities that govern whether we can do these transitions or not? And since we're talking about interactions with bad, it's going to be important to talk about, you know, can we have reversible, maybe pure transformations on the whole system, including the bath? What does that tell you about the transformations you can do? So I'll leave it there, but I think this is starting, just opening up a promising line of work for understanding the nature of thermodynamics. Thanks.
Questions? We have time for two or three questions.
So is this assumption of spectrality on the way, is it somehow related to assumption of spectrality in Ausenschild's framework? Like there is, they have the definition of the spectral convex set, and, which allows them, under this assumption, something simplified.
Yeah. So it's the weak spectrality is definitely weaker. I think even the unique spectrality is weaker. But what I call projectivity, I think, is very close, maybe the same as Alfsein's and Schultz's spectrality. Because Alfsein and Schultz have filters onto every phase. This notion of filter is just the dual of their notion.
It's like every exposed phase is projective or something.
Yeah. So that I think, is their notion of projective convex set. I'm going to have to go look it up.
Me too.
It's close to it. They talk about decomposing. So their notion is stronger than just the thing we're calling spectrality, but it's close. It's our project.
More questions?